Talk Show.
Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we're seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We're seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it'll be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you're already starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is May 29, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink is here for the seventh installment of the Traitors series. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh. How are you
Absolutely.
Doing?
Praise Yahweh. Are you psyched out that the rapture began apparently last week in secret, and it's going to finish in October?
Right. The more Jews go to heaven, the better between now and October. Right. Harold Camping, all those date setters, it's the same old pattern that's been going on for years. They set a date, nothing happens, and they always have a fallback date or a miscalculation, or they were wrong about some little thing, but this big thing's still true, but it's not going to happen for another 6 months.
And meanwhile, they upset millions of people and discourage a lot more people. And I'm sure.
Well, Harold Camping is a Jew. I'm sorry. Harold Camping is a Jew. And he's just out to make a buck and discredit Christianity at the same time, and it's very effective.
And the Jews are going to cover for him just like they covered for Alger Hiss.
No doubt. They covered for Alger Hiss, that they're still covering for him 50 years later, and we'll see that tonight. Yeah, you know, this Alger Hiss thing, I know it's been long, it's drawn out, this is the seventh installment, but I think it's important to show, and he's just the tip of the iceberg, right? Alger Hiss is just the tip of the iceberg when he was finally caught up with, and the FBI knew it for years. They told Franklin Roosevelt three or four times that he was a communist, and Roosevelt never cared. And that's basically because Franklin Roosevelt was a communist.
Absolutely. So
that the capitalism and communism, and Adolf Hitler warned about it. Adolf Hitler warned about it in the 1920s, that capitalism and communism were two arms of international Jewry working together towards an international globalism, commercial globalism. And we were warned about that. And nowhere is that more evident than in the Roosevelt administration in the closing months or maybe the closing year of World War II. And I think that this Alger Hiss thing has given us the opportunity to show how he, as a communist agent, was connected with the giveaway at Yalta, was connected with the giveaway of China after the Japanese surrender, he was the giveaway of half of Europe at Yalta, and the founding of the United Nations, which was basically founded right from the beginning as a communist world government.
Absolutely. They should have called it the Junited Nations.
And Alger Hiss was behind all of these horrible things that our nation did, what we capitulated to global communism at the end of the war. With no reason, because militarily, we had the upper hand by far.
Absolutely.
Russia was exhausted. George Patton could have whooped their butts with just his own tank divisions.
And the Jewish media would rather that we spend decades focusing on, was he guilty, was he innocent? Oh, was he guilty, was he innocent? And we debate that instead of looking at what happened because of his actions. And the wider implications for the fact that the regime in power, the Rosenfeld government, allowed it to happen and made it happen.
Well, yes, they made it happen because they wanted it to happen. Because the Jews on Wall Street wanted it to happen. And they're the ones that put Roosevelt into power and kept him there for 13 years. That the only thing that took him out was his death, right? He may still be the president.
I'm sure the Greatest Generation, that they'd have kept voting for him again and again.
Well, absolutely. The Greatest Generation. Who wrote that book, Tom Brokaw? They were the Greatest Generation of traitors and whores for the Jews. Whores for international Judaism. And Christians should really be standing in opposition to Judaism as Christ and the apostles stood in opposition to Judaism.
The funny thing is there are some British people that blame us for what happened to Poland, saying that Churchill wanted to save Poland from Stalin, but the U.S. backed down.
Well, the U.S. purposely withdrew. We had troops almost to the Polish border, and purposely they were held back for the Soviets.
That had already been decided probably several years ago. Certainly it had been finalized at Yalta, but I'm sure that the U.S. knew exactly what was going to happen post-war, well before Yalta.
Well, right. It was that was a done deal before Tehran, before Yalta, before any of those conferences. I'm sure. Roosevelt was willing to, and his cabinet, his key advisors were all communist agents at Yalta, Alger Hiss, and Harry Hopkins, and even that Charles Bolin. Charles Bolin is never suspected of being a communist, but he's awfully sympathetic to everything that the Bolsheviks were about, to everything Stalin was about.
We would call him a fellow traveler.
I would consider him to be a communist in action, even though he wasn't in name. He was 100% sympathetic to capitulation to the Russians, the Jews controlling Russia, I should say. And this is, you know, we have to, as a people, we have to wake up to understand that World War II was really a fight between Christian Germany and Germany's right to self-determination and world Jewry.
Absolutely.
And we fought on the side of world Jewry.
It wasn't a war of German conquest of Europe. It was a war of Germany and her other Axis power allies fighting to stop the Jews from taking over the whole of the world.
Well, right. Absolutely. And Hitler spelled that out in Mein Kampf. He knew it 15 years before it happened, what was going on.
And, of course, there's some idiots today who insist that Hitler was out to take over the whole world.
Well, right. It's really the Jews that have been out to take over the whole world, and they've damn well succeeded. All the while, Satan's been taking over the world and pointing it at a straw man that he sets up as the devil, whether it be this straw man 1 year and another straw man another year. It doesn't matter.
And the Jews claim that Hitler's the devil. So here right. They are. They're the devil, yet whoever stands in their way must become the devil.
Absolutely. Well, Satan means adversary, so if you're adversarial to the Jews, you become Satan in the eyes of the Jew. But that's the Christian's job. That's the Christian's obligation, is to withstand Judaism.
And if you're loyal to God and you follow God, you'll naturally be adversarial to the Jew. And I pointed out to some people, like what you said, if America were a true Christian society, the Jew would either have to feed himself through farming or an honest trade, or he'd have to leave, or his other alternative would be to starve to death. And since he can't engage in an honest trade, he'd either have to be okay with starving or he'd have to leave, because the porn stores, the pawn shops, the abortion clinics, the usury banks, those would all be gone. So his options would be very limited.
Well, absolutely. But if you're a Christian and you have usury debt loan, you have to get rid of that, or you're not fulfilling your obligation and withstanding the Jew. If you're a Christian and you spend money on Hollywood movies and all of the other poisons and the idols which the Jew has set up in our society, you have to cleanse yourself of them, or you're not standing in opposition to Judaism. You become an antichrist by taking the side of the enemies of Christ, by supporting them, by supporting their filth, by buying their poisons, by feeding those poisons to your kids. You become an antichrist. And that's something that Christians have to be made to learn.
All right. Would you like to take over from where we left off on Hiss?
Well, absolutely. This is the what we've read in this Conservapedia article that we've been following, and all the information that we've been adding to it. We are up to where the State Department issued some reports concerning all of the many known communists or suspected communists or communist sympathizers. They had different levels, and basically there were hundreds of communists or communist sympathizers working for the United States government in various positions in Washington, and especially in the State Department. And there were several hundred of them. And 108 of them, I believe, were solid security risks that were known to the government. No action was ever taken against any of these people. That's why we had Joe McCarthy several years later. That's why we had the House Committee on Un-American Activities and those investigations in 1947, 1948, right?
Just curious here, at the top of this list, was the name Alger Hiss there?
Well, yes, Alger Hiss was right at the top of the list. And we're at that point where the State Department admits that this is going on and has been going on. And in 1946, the Republican Party had taken Congress and the Senate for the first time since the beginning of the Depression, right? So we're picking up right there in this article. And now I will begin with House Committee on Un-American Activities Redux, because they had already discussed that committee earlier in the article. What follows is in reference to the previous State Department investigations of the communist government, which the newly elected Republican Congress of 1946 was making a commotion about. Truman played it all off as partisan politics and continued to run cover for the communists, which permeated the Democratic Party in Washington. And some of those communists, such as McGeorge Bundy, they continued in the employ of Democratic presidents all the way through the Johnson administration. We have had, and we still have, these same communists. I should call them their theological descendants, and that's what they are, in Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and Barbara Boxer and Chuck Schumer. And all these people are direct ideological descendants and theological descendants from these communists that gave away the world to the Bolsheviks in 1945 and through the Truman administration. That there's no doubt in my mind. That now I'll pick
out of the Columbia, haven't they?
Well, Columbia University and a couple other schools were, and Columbia gave us the Frankfurt School and a whole lot of other Jewish treachery, and Columbia University has been used as a launching pad for the destruction of America since the 1920s, there's no doubt. That March, in a bid to steal the GOP's thunder, Truman enacted a loyalty program that this was he was doing damage control here, right? Despite which, according to State Department security files, there were still 108 cases there of communists following fall. Even before the grand jury convened, meaning the Alger Hiss grand jury, the FBI learned that the Truman administration, acutely aware that an untimely public disclosure about Hiss could have easily torpedoed Truman's hopes for the 1948 presidential election, they conspired to subvert the grand jury process in order to cover up the problem of Soviet penetration. The grand jury sat for nearly a year, July 22, 1947 to July 20, 1948, during which the Justice Department never called Whitaker Chambers, the star witness against Hiss, in the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings. The Justice Department never called Whitaker Chambers to testify against, in response to communists in government, which would have included Alger Hiss, during that entire year that the grand jury sat. And that is definitely the Truman administration throwing monkey wrenches in the cogs of the wheels of justice, right? Because, I mean, the prosecutors, government prosecutors, are employees of the executive branch of government, and therefore they serve at the convenience of the president. That's just a fact of the way our government's set up. That's how Bill Clinton was able to fire them all. Yeah, there was some criticism, but it was his right. And George Bush was able to file several. George Bush fired 8 government prosecutors, and this is George W. Bush, right, or the second Bush. And he caught hell in the media for it. Bill Clinton, in 1993, fired practically all of them, and the media never even gave him any sweat over it. And that's because we have a communist media that's always been that's always kowtowed to what they perceive as a progressive democratic agenda.
Well, hypothetically, if I were the president and I had 200 or 300 known neo-Nazis in the government, that'd probably be the end of me.
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt that the media drumbeat would start and it would get louder and louder until you were the new Nixon. That's the way it is. Without his, meaning Whitaker Chambers' testimony, the grand jury had no corroboration of Bentley, meaning Elizabeth Bentley, the reformed and admitted Russian spy and supposedly reformed communist, right? As a result, it did not indict a single federal employee for espionage. Instead, the Truman Justice Department obtained indictments of the open leaders of the above-ground Communist Party, not for espionage, but for violations of the Smith Act. Now, the open members of the above-ground Communist Party, of course, would not be federal employees. The Smith Act of 1940 made it illegal to advocate the overthrow of the United States government by force or to be involved with any such group. And the Communist Party, USA, actually did advocate the overthrow of the United States by force. There's no doubt.
Read the main text of the Smith Act?
Well, yeah, sure, if you'd like.
It makes it a federal crime with fines and imprisonment for up to 20 years, denying all employment with the federal government for 5 years following a conviction for anyone who, quote, with intent to cause the overthrow or destruction of any such government, prints, publishes, edits, issues, circulates, sells, distributes, or publicly displays any written or printed matter advocating, advising, or teaching the duty, necessity, desirability, or propriety of overthrowing or destroying any government in the United States by force or violence, or attempts to do so, or organizes or helps, or attempts to organize any society, group, or assembly of persons who teach, advocate, or encourage the overthrow or destruction of any such government by force or violence, or becomes or is a member of or affiliates with any such society, group, or assembly of persons knowing the purposes thereof.
Well, you know something? I really believe that the enforcement of the Smith Act, and the Smith Act was used during the 1940s to imprison open members of the Communist Party, but as we've seen all the testimony over these last 6 weeks, and we've seen it from many different people, we've seen it from defected Russian spies, we've seen it from the since then opened Soviet archives, what we've seen it from reformed communists like Whitaker Chambers, we've seen it from men like Nathaniel Wheel in his testimony at the McCarthy hearings, and I quoted them earlier in this series. What we've seen, that there were many card-carrying Communist Party USA members in the federal government working for the Roosevelt administration, for the State Department, for the Treasury Department, and especially the launching pad for that. It seemed that the gateway was the Agricultural Adjustment Agency. I really believe that with the Smith Act, that the communists behind the scenes and working in government were actually throwing under the bus, so to speak, communists that weren't in government to put on a smoke and mirrors dog and pony show, right? Hey, we're going after communists. And in the meantime, they're the communists that are doing the most damage.
The overt communists weren't really expecting to be employable by the federal government, though. They were expecting to just be radicals and march through the streets.
Well, right, and they're the ones they were thrown under the bus.
And interestingly enough,
so that they could continue their treachery in government.
During the war, the Smith Act was used against people like, you know, Gerald L. K. Smith, Elizabeth Dilling, Charles Coughlin for the Great Sedition Trials.
Well, right, and we're going to cover the Great Sedition Trials, I think, after this series on traitors. But first we have to talk about Harry Hopkins and Harry Dexter White, perhaps not to the same degree as Alger Hiss, but we have to spend at least a program or two on those people, and Dean Acheson and a few others. The Republican back to the Conservapedia article. The Republican Congress responded by opening its own investigation of espionage suspects, including Lachlan Curry, Harry Dexter White, and Alger Hiss. The Democratic Truman stonewalled issuing a presidential directive that cut Congress off from all access to FBI and other information on loyalty or security cases. There was an actual order signed that said any subpoena or demand or request for information, reports, or files of the nature described received from sources other than those persons in the executive branch of the government shall be respectfully declined. And to me, this is it's a catch-22 situation. This is what would seem to be a violation of the traditionally recognized balance of power in our federal government, which consists in checks and balances. It clearly seems to be an abuse of power on Truman's part, because I don't think that Congress would voluntarily create an organization that would allow a president to take the law into his own hands, so to speak. But the fact of the matter is that the organization, once it was created by Congress, and we needed a bill of Congress to create an agency such as the FBI. However, the agency exists in the executive branch of government, and the agency answers to the president. And that's what executive orders weren't initiated in this country to replace the laws passed by Congress, right? Executive orders were really instituted so that the president could express his will to the executive branch of government, how they were to enforce the laws and how they were to operate under his presidency, which is all well and good and it's all legal. But executive orders lately have actually become abused, because they're seen as replacing the law, and they're not supposed to. The president cannot. The president has no power to make law. He can only tell executive bodies how he wants them to function, and that's so fair.
We now have presidents who, like Reagan and Clinton and Bush 1 and Bush 2, with the stroke of a pen, they give amnesty to all sorts of illegals. With the stroke of a pen, they enact new gun control legislation, but they're not the legislature.
Well, right, and all that is clearly an overstepping of their boundaries according to the Constitution, because they should not be allowed to do such things.
Supreme Court should be all over them for that, and I think it's impeachment worthy.
There should be impeachments over that, and there aren't, and it's a sad state of our society that the bankers that finance the presidents and their elections also finance the bankers win no matter who signs what, right? The bankers always win in this country, and people don't see that. People don't see the commercialization of politics under that one Supreme Court ruling, which was absolutely crooked, that made corporations people, right? And corporations can't be people. They should never have the rights that people have. And I forget the ruling. It was a railroad case in California in the late 19th century. Oh, okay, well, cut back to the article.
Is that Santa Clara County v. Southern Pacific?
Yeah, that's the case. That case is probably the most horrible case in the history of the United States, because that case was where from that day on the government basically was recognizing corporations as people and giving corporations the rights of free speech that people are supposed, real flesh and blood men, have from God. That's the way the founders saw it. Corporations are artificial entities. They should not have any rights, God-given rights. They're corporations. And Thomas Jefferson wrote, he didn't use the word corporation, but he wrote, "Beware of permanent persons." A corporation is basically a permanent entity which can transcend the life of a man, right? It's sad, but that's what this nation has become. And that one court case which was upheld what was probably the most treacherous case, I think, in our history.
Unanimous ruling.
Yeah, and it made corporations people, basically. Corporations can't be people. It's sick. It's a case only a Jew could love. Okay, cut off from investigative data, Congress interviewed witnesses itself, following up on testimony given by Bentley. On August 3rd, Whitaker Chambers was finally called upon to testify, not before the grand jury, but before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. He repeated under oath what he had been telling State Department security officials and the FBI about the Ware Group for a decade. He'd been telling the FBI about the Ware Group for a decade, and we'd seen earlier in this presentation from other sources that the FBI on several occasions warned Roosevelt about Alger Hiss being a communist, and Roosevelt just laughed it off because Roosevelt was a damn communist. Okay, this is what Whitaker Chambers told the House Un-American Activities Committee. I was a member of the Communist Party and a paid functionary of the party. The apparatus to which I was attached was an underground organization of the United States Communist Party developed, to the best of my knowledge, by Harold Ware. He's just one group. Harold Ware was just one ringleader of a spy group in Washington. We've seen at least four of them, I think, mentioned Nathaniel Wheel and several others mentioned in this series that were all operating in Washington at this time.
And I want to point out about the House and Un-American Activities Committee, it was, you know, a key role in its founding, according to Conservapedia, was Samuel Dickstein, who was born in Vilnius, Lithuania, and moved to New York City. And then he helped found this committee, which was originally, he wanted it to go after Nazis and Klansmen, and the NKVD was paying him tens of thousands of dollars at the time. So maybe that's why they didn't vigorously go after Hiss.
Could be, but there were several spy groups.
What was that?
It's the Ware Group, the Silver Master Group, the Wheel Group. It's incredible. Silver Master, Nathan Silver Master, remember him? We discussed. Okay, the head of the underground group at the time I knew was Nathan Witt. Later, John
All right, I'll take over for Bill while we're waiting. He repeated under oath what he had been telling State Department security officials and the FBI about the Ware Group for a decade. Quote, I was a member of the Communist Party and a paid functionary of the party. The apparatus to which I was attached was an underground organization of the United States Communist Party developed, to the best of my knowledge, by Harold Ware. The head of the underground group at the time I knew it was Nathan Vitt. Later, John Apt became the leader. Lee Pressman was also a member of this group, as was Alger Hiss. The purpose of this group at that time was not primarily espionage. Its original purpose was the communist infiltration of the American government, but espionage was certainly one of its eventual objectives. Bill, are you there? Bill, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. It sounded like you were talking into a blender or a fan, and some people said you sounded like a demon.
I have no idea what happened. I mean, I tested my connection on the test service, on the call testing service, and I was fine. I don't know what happened. Okay.
All right. You want to keep going, or shall I?
Well. Yeah, I was saying that, yeah, you know, remember all the discussions that, I don't know how much people heard of what I said, right? We're talking about Whitaker Chambers, but we're talking about how Chambers was, what we were talking about, the purpose of the Ware Group, which was one of several spy groups operating in Washington in the Roosevelt administration in the 1930s and 40s. Among them were the group led by Nathan Silvermaster, and there was another group led by, I think, Elizabeth Bentley, and another group led by Nathaniel Wheel. And there were a whole bunch of, they were independent. A lot of them knew each other. They knew the other people in the other groups were communists, but they didn't really work with them. They worked with their own group. Sometimes the group's members would switch from one group to another. We've seen that. We've seen disputes concerning that. And basically, there were a whole bunch of independent spy groups that were operating in the Roosevelt administration. It's incredible when you think about how many there were and how intertwined they were with the various federal agencies. That basically, we had Bolsheviks running the United States. That's why we were so sympathetic to Bolshevism. We were blinded to it because Bolsheviks were running America. And we voted for it because our people voted for Roosevelt four times. It's incredible. America's just as... Well, we are just as communist as the communists are, and we don't even know it. And that's why this nation has been such heaven for the Jew. Well, what we saw... The Ware Group, Chambers tells us here, was that their objective, their function was to populate the American government with communists. And we saw that all the discussions of all the people that Hiss had recommended for positions in the government, he was recommending communists for positions in government. And dozens probably of people got hired on Hiss's recommendations, and this had come out in some of the House Un-American Activities Committee and the later McCarthy hearing transcripts will testify to this. And we saw that, and this is important to note because we'll see it again later. Alger Hiss himself, he was a underling and Felix Frankfurter of the Supreme Court Justice, the Jew, Felix Frankfurter. And Felix Frankfurter was responsible for getting a lot of these men into our government. And Dean Acheson, as we shall see, also what was a former employee and a former clerk and very close to Felix Frankfurter. When Chambers testified against Hiss, wrote Pseudo-Platov, that this is a Russian historian writing from the Russian archives, We consider this to be a setback for GRU intelligence activities in the United States. 4 months later, Anatoly Gorsky, chief of Soviet intelligence in the U.S. during World War II, would author an internal Soviet secret police memorandum entitled Failures in the USA, 1938-1948, listing 43 Soviet sources and intelligence officers likely to have been identified to U.S. authorities. Included on the list, included under the heading Carl's Group, Carl being Whitaker Chambers' code name, was Alger Hiss, former employee of the State Department. That same month, Peter Fedotov and Konstantin Kukin, two other senior Soviet intelligence officials, reported to the chairman of Soviet intelligence about, quote, our former agents who were betrayed by Whitaker Chambers. Whitaker Chambers, I don't know if you had read this, Brian, or if it had been I don't know if you had got the chance to read this in my absence here. Cut off from investigative data, when the Truman administration cut off Congress from the data which the FBI had collected. Congress interviewed witnesses itself, following up on the testimony given by Elizabeth Bentley. On August 3rd, Whitaker Chambers was finally called to testify, not before the grand jury, but before the House Committee on Un-American Activities.
I read that little quote that he gave in his testimony.
Okay. Well, basically, Whitaker Chambers had been telling the FBI for 10 years about some of these communists in government, and nobody did anything about it. The FBI, we had read that the FBI had went and reported it to Roosevelt, and he laughed it off. It's incredible. Okay, 2 days after Chambers, Alger Hiss testified before the same House committee, denying that he ever knew Chambers. That denial would eventually become his undoing. In a statement Secretary of State Dean Acheson helped write, Hiss asked the committee to disregard the evidence and follow its emotions. Yeah, you know, Dean Acheson was always running cover for the communist Hiss. He covered for him a few times, and he was even still supporting him after he went to prison. And I don't think this could have been a coincidence. These two men had known each other for a long, long time, and both of these men worked for, and they were both very close to the Jewish Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter. And Dean Acheson later went on to become the Secretary of State under Truman. And I would bet that he was a closet communist. I would bet on it, because his defense of Hiss and the way he stuck by Hiss time and time again, he had to know what Hiss was doing.
Who, Acheson?
Oh, definitely.
Well, look what Acheson did. He basically destroyed any hope of having a pro-U.S. Chinese government. And he also helped tank the war in Vietnam.
Well, right. And it was Alger Hiss's influence, which I believe laid the initial policies in the Roosevelt administration for China, and especially in giving so much of China over to the Russians, and guaranteeing, I think that Alger Hiss helped guarantee China would fall into communist hands, and Dean Acheson just simply finished the work that Hiss had begun. The day of Hiss's testimony. I'm sorry, let me read Hiss's testimony. That there's a quote here, which they say that Acheson helped write. This is Alger Hiss talking before the House Un-American Activities Committee. It is inconceivable that there could have been, on my part, meaning Alger Hiss, during 15 years or more in public office, any departure from the highest rectitude without its being known. Well, you know something, what Alger Hiss perceived as the highest rectitude is different than what most of those members of that committee would perceive, right? That there's no doubt. So he's not really lying. It is inconceivable that the men with whom I was intimately associated during those 15 years should not know that my true character better than this, should not know my true character better than this accuser. It is inconceivable that, et cetera, et cetera. This article doesn't finish the quote, but basically it's Hiss's attacks were ad hominem, and they were very obscurely and vaguely worded. Well, of course, the men that were working with the communist Alger Hiss, Charles Bolin, who was sympathetic to Russia, Dean Acheson, who was his bedfellow, and Harry Hopkins, who was a communist spy, and Harry Dexter White, and Franklin Roosevelt himself, who was very sympathetic to the communists and laughed off at any accusations concerning this, of course they wouldn't have thought anything bad of his. That he was doing exactly what they all expected.
Well, that's why they covered for him and promoted him.
Absolutely. So Hiss is using that as a defense. And it's basically, it's a whole nest of vipers. The day of Hiss's testimony, President Truman finally reviewed Hiss's FBI file, pronouncing Hiss, quote-unquote, guilty as hell. Truman told White House Special Counsel Samuel Rosenman, what religion do you think he is? We shouldn't just indict this son of a bitch. We should hang him. But here's the kicker. 5 minutes later, Truman blustered to a press conference that the Hiss case was just an election year red herring, a characterization that he would repeat as late as 1956. When Rosenman, the Jew, later asked why he had lied, Truman explained, "You don't understand. The Republicans aren't after Alger Hiss, they're after me. I had to take the political view." That year, Truman told Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, there were too many unknowns in the partially decoded Venona messages, saying, even if part of this is true, it would open up the whole red panic again. In her newspaper column, Eleanor Roosevelt set the tone of respectable opinion, don't ask me how, smearing good people like Lachlan Curry, Alger Hiss, and others is, I think, unforgivable. The words of Eleanor Roosevelt, the communist whore. Anyone knowing either Mr. Curry or Mr. Hiss, who are the two people whom I happen, Eleanor Roosevelt, to know fairly well, would not need any denial on their part to know they are not communists. Their records prove it.
Well,
quite the contrary.
Yeah.
Right, they're all communists. And she's a liar. And it's absolutely certain. It's incredible that because that these people are able to disguise themselves as liberals, and because the American people are stupid enough to think there's a difference between a liberal and a communist, or a progressive and a communist, when there's really no difference at all, they're able to just purport just about any lie and get away with it. It's absolutely incredible. They're still lying to us today as liberals and progressives. And they're still getting away with it. And because the media is controlled by the Jews, and the media has run cover and for these so-called liberals and progressives for 100 years now, the American people will never be able to see the truth, because they don't open their eyes past the mainstream Jewish media. Everything they think they know comes from the mainstream Jewish media. They think there's a difference between a progressive and a liberal. They think there's a difference between a communist and a liberal. There's no difference at all.
The liberal is basically just a communist who's not wearing the Bolshevik uniform.
Well, right. A true liberal is basically a communist. There's no doubt.
The ideology is all the same.
Yes, it is. And that's, they hide behind these labels and make distinctions that don't really exist. And people buy into this as if they're credible. Eleanor Roosevelt is not a credible testament of who's a communist and who's not.
If you see a wolf dressed up as a sheep, you ought to know that sheep are supposed to go baa, baa. They're not supposed to howl at the moon, so if it's howling like a wolf, it's a wolf. So I don't care what you call a communist is a communist.
The Hiss forces... I'm sorry, I'm missing it again. When Hiss testified, most of those watching, including members of the press, appeared to be on Hiss's side. Imagine that. all those communist members of the press appeared to be on Hiss's side. Wow, why am I not surprised? Even giving him a round of applause when he finished. So strong was Hiss's denial that the committee wanted to drop the investigation. But one member, freshman Congressman Richard Nixon, Republican of California, insisted that either Chambers or Hiss was lying about whether one had known the other. He asked the committee to appoint him to head a subcommittee to find out which of the two were lying. The Truman administration fixed its sights not on Hiss, but on Chambers. Truman aide George Elsey, advising White House counsel Clark Clifford on August 16th, justice should make every effort to ascertain if Whitaker Chambers is guilty of perjury. No suggestion was made that justice make any effort at all to ascertain if Hiss might be guilty of perjury. The Hiss forces launched a frightful campaign of vilification against Chambers, a whispering campaign of lies and innuendos. Many editorialists and communists violently attacked him and defended Hiss. Let me tell you something. I really believe that Alger Hiss is a defining moment in the state of politics in this nation, because the media and the Democratic Party were allowed to obscure this issue for so long, and the Republicans and so-called conservatives took the bait. There should have never been a debate over this. With all of the testimony, with all of the proofs from Russian archives and Russians who defected in various other sources, and the FBI had a lot of this collected in the days of the Roosevelt administration, there should have never been a debate. But this debate over the guilt of the Rosenbergs and the guilt of Alger Hiss, which was played out in the media, allowed 10,000 other crimes to slip by and never really get investigated because we couldn't get past this debate. That's the way I see the last 70 years of history. That the I'd like to read an article by Jack Cashill now from WorldNet Daily on the 50-year fraud of Alger Hiss. But we have to look beyond these things and look at how much went by unnoticed. How many crimes, communist crimes, Jewish communist crimes in the Roosevelt and Truman administrations basically went by unnoticed because we couldn't get past this debate over Alger Hiss. And it shows that the divisions between people in this nation is a lot deeper than a lot of people would ever suspect. This is Jack Cashill, and there's an editor's note. The following commentary is excerpted from Jack Cashill's eye-opening new book, Hoodwinked: How Intellectual Hucksters Have Hijacked American Culture. And let me say, there's a pretty good chapter in the book on the Negro Alex Haley, author of the book Roots, and how he is a fraud from the beginning also. And it's most of us know that. But it's nice to see a non-Christian identity writer writing on somebody's topics. I am not and have never been a member of the Communist Party, Alger Hiss said under oath on August 5th, 1948, and calmly refuted accusation of former Soviet agent Whitaker Chambers. Refuted the accusation. The House Un-American Activities Committee had subpoenaed Chambers 2 days before. Then a senior editor at Time Magazine, Chambers had testified reluctantly. Hiss, however, was not content to deny his communist ties. So far as I know, he added, I have never laid eyes on Chambers, and I should like the opportunity to do so. The unruffled demeanor of Alger Hiss unnerved the House Un-American Activities Committee members who had trusted Chambers, but it did not surprise Chambers. He knew from experience that Hiss had the strength to be a communist. That sense of moral superiority, which makes communists, though caught in crime, berate their opponents with withering self-righteousness. What would have shocked Chambers if Hiss had yielded and wept and told the truth? It would take 50 years to satisfy the educable among the cultural establishment that, on this memorable August day, Hiss was lying through his teeth. The only proof that many on the left would accept, even then kicking and screaming, came from the hardest of lefts, the people who had supervised both Chambers and Hiss, the Soviets themselves. In the interim, Hiss seduced America's easily led progressive elite into perhaps the most preposterously enduring multimedia fraud in American history, a 50-year roadshow whose fictions were obvious to the disinterested observer from day one. Well, first, there's still a lot of people on the hardened left that defend and run cover for Alger Hiss. There are still people, and at the end of this segment, I hope to be able to read some lines from a New York Times article of 1996 which demonstrate that. Although the contours have not been fully mapped, Hiss chose a speedy route to communism. Having rejected God, he saw FDR's inauguration as a holy moment. Soon after, he took a post at the new Agricultural Adjustment Administration. There he fell in with other idealistic young men, presumably keen on changing the world faster than FDR could or would. And by 1935, Hiss had joined aspiring, known to history as the Harold Ware Group. Chambers, meanwhile, had been sent to Washington to organize a new apparatus, and his first apparatchik, he was offered Hiss, a rising star in the Ware Group. Hiss would not disappoint. He left the Agricultural Adjustment Agency to serve as counsel for a committee meeting investigating munitions. That was the Gerald Nye investigation, right? And from there, he moved on to the State Department. At State, he proved willing and able to funnel documents to Chambers. Chambers finally broke with the party in 1938. When he again met Hiss in 1948, the seeming advantage was all Hiss's. Tall and trim with his academic pedigree and patrician bearing, Hiss had advanced swiftly through the State Department to become director of the Office of Special Political Affairs. In that role, he worked closely with Secretary of State Edward Stettinius. In February 1945, Hiss had traveled with Stettinius to the Yalta Conference in the Soviet Union. There, FDR, Churchill, and Stalin divided the world among them, much to Stalin's satisfaction. At the very least, Hiss helped draft the documents that sealed the deal. After the conference, he was also able to visit Moscow. In the spring of 1945, Hiss helped Stettinius plan for the new United Nations, then housed in San Francisco. On an interim basis, Hiss even served as the UN's first general secretary. Also helping Stettinius, oddly enough, was Hollywood 10 communist Dalton Trumbo. Well, Stettinius, as Secretary of State, he's never been set out as a communist, but he has always surrounded himself with communists. That can't be a mistake. It just can't be. In the 2 weeks preceding the trip to the Pacific, Trumbo wrote casually to a friend, "I went to San Francisco and ghosted," he wrote, "Stettinius' report to the nation on the UN conference." After the war, his increasingly wary superiors finessed Hiss out of the State Department, and he accepted a prestigious position as president of the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace. Elegant and quintessentially Anglo-Saxon, Hiss moved in the best of circles. His establishment friends were appropriately appalled when the self-described, short, squat, solitary Chambers had come out of nowhere to impugn Hiss before this committee of know-nothings. When Hiss coldly rebutted Chambers' charges 2 days later, his friends cheered. Biographer John Chabot Smith described Hiss's presentation to the House Un-American Activities Committee as a triumph. Most of the press were on his side. Yeah, they were all communists, adds Smith. Many of the established papers weighed in with scathing editorials about the already unpopular House Un-American Activities Committee. Well, it's the communists, it's the Jewish-controlled media that made it unpopular, right? Most of its members wanted to drop Hiss and move on to some more vulnerable prey. It took a first-term congressman from California to check the retreat. The young Richard Nixon finally convinced his colleagues that they did not have to prove that Hiss was a communist. That would be admittedly difficult. They only had to prove that Hiss was a liar And they could do this by showing that he knew Chambers, which he denied. Hiss and Chambers had to meet. Their first public confrontation, this sad play in Chambers' words, took place 12 days after the Hiss denial. It bordered on the surreal. At first, Hiss feigned uncertainty as to whether he had ever seen Chambers before. "Will you ask him to say something?" Hiss said to Nixon. When Chambers began to speak, Hiss looked puzzled. He then said to Chambers, as he might to a small child, "Would you mind opening your mouth wider?" Chambers complied. Preposterous as it seemed to Chambers and Nixon, Hiss wanted to check his dental work. Still faking ignorance, Hiss asked that Chambers name the dentist who had done the work. Nixon could take no more of this dumb show, as he knew the two men and their families had been intimates for 4 years. Chambers had even stayed with the Hisses on several occasions. They all looked much the same like they had just 10 years ago. "Excuse me," Nixon interrupted. "Before we leave the teeth, Mr. Hiss, do you feel that you would have to have the dentist tell you what he did to the teeth before you could tell us anything about this man?" The comedy had gone far enough, Nixon had concluded, and with good reason. A few minutes into this first official encounter, it should have been plain to all who were willing to see that Chambers was telling the truth and Hiss wasn't even coming close. Still, the comedy persisted. Hiss pleaded his innocence through multiple hearings and trials before finally being convicted for perjury. In March 1951, after exhausting his appeals, Hiss entered federal prison, a convicted traitor in the eyes of all of America, except, of course, its cultural elite, we know who they are, who insisted on his innocence in book after book for the next 40 years. In July of 1995, however, the U.S. government opened its own files, the so-called Venona Archives, a massive collection of the messages it had successfully decoded from the Soviet Union between 1942 and 1946. The files, however incomplete, were stunning. They showed that the Soviets had spies in every significant American military or diplomatic agency, no fewer than 349 in all. Among them was a particularly valuable agent codenamed Ailes. One message from a Washington-based NKVD agent to Moscow in March 1945 provided a good deal of detail about Ailes. It told of how he had been working with the GPU since 1935, and he now managed a small group that included his own relatives, that it had been focusing on military information, and that the whole group had been awarded Soviet medals, and that Ailes himself had gone to the Yalta Conference and stopped afterward in Moscow to meet with the Soviet deputy's foreign minister. All of the details fit Alger Hiss, including the Moscow stopover after Yalta. The Venona files led researchers to look elsewhere in the Soviet archives, and almost everywhere they looked, they found gold. Detail after detail confirmed Chambers' story and shot silver bullets into Hiss's undying heart. Still, no evidence could or would breach the fact-proof barricades of the hardened left. In 1997, the same year that he was declaring Mumia's innocence, Ward Churchill was declaring Hiss's as well. And that's just a demonstration of the that's just some of the evidence against Hiss that Cashel notes in this article, but it shows how the left has been ongoing in its defense of Alger Hiss, and Alger Hiss among communists in Washington is only the tip of the iceberg. Once Alger Hiss is seen as the guilty man that he was, well, then a whole lot of other characters have to be looked at, and we see that. Well, once we do that examination, which never, I don't think has ever really been done in a scholarly academic manner or in any academic work, well, once that was done, we have to look at the rest of the Roosevelt administration, and it's easy to see that they were all communists. I mean, they handed this country over to the will of Joseph Stalin and the Jews, that the communist slash capitalist international Jews, during the Second World War. But there should be no doubt. And the entire Roosevelt administration and much of the Truman years, if not Truman himself. Truman was a very partisan individual.
And since Nixon took charge here, the Jews probably didn't forget that, did they? They wanted to hang him out to dry 2 decades
Oh,
later.
I'm sure. That's why I really do think. I mean, Richard Nixon was far from ideal as a president, right? He opened up China, which is 20 years later. It's a total undoing. But I sincerely believe that Richard Nixon was Watergate was a complete setup. I think that Nixon was actually a pretty noble fellow who tried to cover for his boys once they supposedly got themselves in trouble. That's what that's my assessment of the situation. And I'm not. And I have studied Watergate to some extent. I mean, when I was a teenager when I read All the President's Men and Woodward and Bernstein, and I was sucked into that for a couple of years, but it wasn't long until I realized that something was wrong with it, right? Nixon brought Hiss face-to-face with his accuser on August 25th. Hiss, and I'm sorry we've covered some of this in Cash Hill, but I'm repeating it because we're following this Conservapedia article primarily. Hiss stoutly continued to deny the charge, meaning that he's lying about knowing Chambers or not knowing him, reported Time magazine. But it was clear to everyone afterward that he and Chambers had known each other quite well in the mid-1930s. The magazine added that Hiss's favorite phrase, as he fenced tediously with the committee, was, "To the best of my recollection, quote-unquote." He used that phrase and similar phrases 198 times. Chambers offered to take a lie detector test. Hiss refused, a refusal he kept up for the rest of his life. Trying to explain Chambers' charges, Hiss suggested that his accuser was crazy, asking, "Is he a man of consistent reliability, truthfulness, and honor? Indeed, is he a man of sanity?" He demanded that the committee ask his accuser if he had ever been treated for a mental illness. The committee obliged, and Chambers answered, "I have not, period." On the White House memo advising that Chambers be investigated for perjury was inserted a handwritten line, quote, "Investigation of Chambers' confinement in a mental institute," unquote. Again, in other words, the Truman administration was basically overtly seeking to defend Alger Hiss. Again, no suggestion was made that Hiss's mental health history might be subject to investigation. In other words, the Truman administration was soundly one-sided. The FBI had already checked into this, and Hoover had reported to Attorney General Tom Clark, quote, "With regard to Whitaker Chambers, there is nothing indicated in the files of the Bureau or in the files of the New York office that Chambers had been institutionalized." In falling for the fiction that Chambers had been committed to an insane asylum, propaganda spread by his side, of course, the Truman administration was taken in by disinformation being spread by the American Communist Party and Alger Hiss's partisans. In an act of supreme hubris, Hiss dared Chambers to repeat his charges outside of the immunity afforded in congressional hearings so that Hiss could sue him, taunting, "And I hope you will do it damned quickly." Just 2 days after their public testimony, Chambers called Hiss's bluff on NBC's Meet the Press, saying Alger Hiss was a communist and may be now. Embarrassment mounted among Hiss partisans as weeks dragged by with no suit filed. The New York Daily News asked, "Well, Alger, where's that suit?" Even the Washington Post, the most implacable of the pro-Hiss newspapers, according to Chambers, began to have doubts, writing, quote, "As yet, no formal action to initiate a suit for slander has publicly been taken by Mr. Hiss. Mr. Hiss himself has created a situation in which he is obliged to put up or shut up. Mr. Hiss has left himself no alternative, and each day of delay in making it known that he will avail himself of the opportunity Mr. Chambers has accorded him does incalculable damage to his reputation." In other words, the newspapers were baiting Hiss to follow in on his promise to sue over Whitaker Chambers' accusation. Finally, after a month, Hiss filed his long-threatened lawsuit against Chambers. The Baltimore documents in a pretrial, this is for the lawsuit, discovery deposition for the suit, Hiss's attorney, William L. Marbury, asked Chambers if he had any correspondence, either typewritten or in handwriting, from Hiss. One of the most disastrous questions ever asked at a deposition. Marbury never expected, nor had he known it, would he have asked for the response that he received. Chambers retrieved the packet he had given his wife's nephew in 1938, which had been hidden in a dumbwaiter shaft. 3 days later, Chambers turned over to Hiss's attorneys 65 pages of typewritten documents and handwritten memoranda, some so sensitive that for security reasons they could not safely be made public. Though already a decade old, Chambers' attorney introduced the documents.
Have they been made public since?
I don't think these papers have ever been made public. I've never seen.
The Kennedy assassination papers and the MLK wiretaps. They're never going to be made available.
Right, probably not, because even the subsequent administrations don't want to know how much this nation's been sold out for since 1913. Right, since the Wilson administration. That's when I would start it.
They all know how much it's been sold out. They don't want us to know.
Well, this article describes it that Whitaker Chambers' attorney goes on to identify all the papers by reading the salutations and the introductions of each one. Hiss conceded that the typed pages appeared to be copies of authentic State Department documents and admitted that all but one of the handwritten memos appeared to be in his handwriting. And Whitaker Chambers had them all. Among the documents confirmed by Hiss's own document experts to be in his handwriting, which contradicted his original denials, was a summary of a telegram that Chambers had quoted almost verbatim in an article he gave to a Herbert Salo in 1938. Assistant U.S. Attorney Thomas J. Dunnigan told the FBI that Assistant Attorney General Alexander M. Campbell, head of the criminal division at Truman Justice, now wants to institute perjury charges against Chambers. And they're still trying to cover for Hiss, right? I wonder why they don't move against Hiss, also was FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover's handwritten comment. The Truman administration's determination to indict Chambers rather than Hiss was unusual, as two leading scholars of the case note, quote, usually when a witness gives false testimony and then later comes forward and provides a truthful account, no perjury charges brought. To charge perjury in such a case would be disincentive for a witness to provide a subsequent truthful account. A perjury count is rarely brought if a witness corrects false testimony in a timely fashion. Chambers corrected his own false sworn testimony within 2 months of his grand jury testimony, and his false testimony has not produced any miscarriage of justice. The Pumpkin Papers, these are interesting. Hoping that they would lead to an indictment of Chambers, Hiss turned over the documents to the Truman Justice Department, the copy that his lawyer had received, right, which immediately impounded and sequestered them. The House Un-American Activities Committee requested copies, but Truman stonewalled.
I hope that Chambers made copies of everything before he sent them in.
Oh yes. Well, his lawyer had copies, right? Hiss turned over his copies, which were provided to his lawyer for the lawsuit discovery, right? On December 1st, the United Press reported, the Justice Department is about ready to drop its investigation of the celebrated Alger Hiss Whitaker Chambers controversy. Well, that's what the Truman administration had hoped, right? The Truman administration may have thought it was done with Hiss, but it wasn't quite finished with Chambers. The next day, an FBI memo reiterated that Justice wanted an immediate investigation by the Bureau to determine whether Chambers committed perjury. Hoover penned, I can't understand why such an effort is being made to indict Chambers to the exclusion of Hiss. Meanwhile, rebuffed in his attempts to see the documents, Nixon asked Chambers on December 1st whether he had any other such material in his possession. The answer was yes. The next day, in a response to a subpoena, Chambers led House Un-American Activities Committee Chief Investigator Robert Stripling on his Maryland farm to a pumpkin he had hollowed out the night before and in which he had secreted five rolls, two developed strips and three undeveloped rolls, one of which later proved to have been light-struck, it was ruined, of 35-millimeter film. The film included 58 frames, mostly photos of State and Navy Department documents dated January 5th through April 1st, 1938. So they were called the pumpkin papers because of where Chambers had hidden the film, right? The State Department documents dealt with a wide variety of subjects, including U.S. intentions with respect to the Soviet Union, the Spanish Civil War, and Germany's takeover of Austria. Some of the documents on the film were initialed by Hiss and came from his office. Some were of a highly sensitive classified nature. Some State Department cables bearing Hiss's handwritten initials had direct bearing on matters of major Soviet interest, including Chinese communist strategy during the war with Japan and Chinese-Soviet relations. As I said, Acheson only finished the policy that Hiss began, right, that Hiss initiated concerning communist China. According to Chambers, some of the microfilm was made by a contact he knew only as Felix, who would photograph documents with the Leica purchased by the communist underground. For such work, said Chambers, Felix had been trained in Moscow, where he traveled on a forged U.S. passport. In 1949, Chambers would lead FBI investigators to the Baltimore block on which he thought Felix had lived in the 1930s. The Bureau discovered that a Felix Inslerman had lived on the block, later moving to Schenectady, New York, where he worked on a secret guided missile project. I wonder who got pictures of that. In 1946, becoming one of the few civilians to attend the atomic tests at Bikini. I wonder what other pictures he took. But before the grand jury and in the second Hiss trial, Inslerman would refuse to answer questions on grounds of potential self-incrimination. But in Inslerman's Schenectady home, the FBI found a Leica whose imperfections matched the scratch marks on Chambers' famed pumpkin film. In 1954, Inslerman would corroborate Chambers' story under oath. He would later turn up on the Gorski memo, codenamed 107th, as would another photographer identified by Chambers, one David Carpenter, whose real name was David Zimmerman, codenamed 103rd. Recently released files reveal that the third photographer identified by Chambers was an ex-GRU agent, William Edward Crane, who admitted to the FBI that he photographed documents from the Treasury and State Department for Chambers in Baltimore. The Truman administration demanded that the House Un-American Activities Committee turn over the film, but Nixon refused. And let me say that the executive branch of government has no such power to demand things from the legislative branch of government, right? The president is not a king.
If he had turned it over, it would have disappeared, and that would have been the end of it.
Well, of course, and Nixon actually stood up to them. He allowed the Justice Department officials to view the film, and he gave them copies, but he would not surrender the film until the Justice Department supplied the House Un-American Activities Committee with copies of the sequestered Baltimore documents. So I guess Chambers didn't keep copies of those documents, right? He turned them all over to the court, evidently, which is foolish, right? But they didn't have Xerox in those days, I don't think. With no other option, the Truman Justice Department, finally called Chambers to testify before a hastily reconvened grand jury on December 6th, more than 16 months after it had originally convened. On that day, Hiss's attorney, Edward McLean, gave the defense's documents examiner J. Howard Herring a batch of old Hiss family letters that Hiss had given him the previous September, 2 months before Chambers produced the documents, immediately identifying the typeface as that of a Woodstock typewriter. Herring reported that one of Mrs. Hiss's 1933 letters was typed on the same machine as the Chambers documents. McLean informed the Hisses of this finding the same day. I guess back then when typewriters were a new invention, they could figure that out, right?
Suppose
according
to that today, they can tell what printer a document came out of.
Yeah, they probably can by the metrics, the page metrics. Yet Hiss swore under oath that he remembered neither the make nor disposition of the typewriter. While the FBI was off on a wild goose chase searching used typewriter stores on the basis of false information furnished by Hiss, his brother Donald Hiss, who was a fellow spy in the State Department, tracked down the Catlets and retrieved the typewriter. Hiss had given this typewriter to this family years before, right? Hiss would later change his story, testifying that he gave the typewriter to the Catlets in 1937, before the date of the documents produced by Chambers. Pat Catlett, however, would tell defense lawyers that Hiss gave the Catlets the typewriter in the spring of 1938, just after the dates of the documents. So it's a really strange case, but there's proof that Hiss's typewriter that he possessed at this time typed these documents with which Whitaker Chambers had produced.
Here he is being caught in yet another lie.
Well, right, and his own lawyers were basically against him on this. It's crazy. On December 13th, the FBI independently located specimens of Priscilla Hiss's typing from the 1930s. The FBI laboratory concluded, like Herring, that all of the papers in question had been typed on the same typewriter, a Woodstock. Another defense expert, Harry E. Cassidy, concluded that Priscilla Hiss not only typed the Chambers documents, but wrote all the handwritten corrections on the typed documents. So we see that all of Hiss's own defense experts are against them, right? Asked by Hiss's attorneys whether it was more likely that Hiss or Chambers had written these corrections, Herring responded, "I am inclined to the opinion that the A.H., Alger Hiss corrections, more closely resemble the questioned writing than do the writings of W.C. Whitaker Chambers." A third defense expert, Edward Fearon, agreed, reporting to the Hiss lawyers, the corrections appearing in Exhibits 5-47 inclusive bear a closer resemblance to the handwritten corrections made by Alger Hiss than to those made by Whitaker Chambers. Fearon added that all but one of the documents were typed on a Woodstock typewriter, number N230099, the one owned by Alger Hiss. On December 15th, Alger Hiss proposed to the grand jury a theory that someone, perhaps Chambers, had sneaked into the State Department and stolen the documents from his desk, then, having somehow obtained access to Hiss's typewriter, typed some of the documents and microfilmed others, and then sneaked back into the State Department and replaced the original papers, all in an elaborate plot to frame Hiss.
Well, you know what? That would make a good movie, wouldn't it?
Right, a decade later, right? Even Hiss admitted that his theory was fantastic, stating, "Until the day I die, I shall wonder how Whitaker Chambers got into my house to use my typewriter," a statement provoking outright laughter among the jurors. That day, Hiss testified that he never gave any documents to Whitaker Chambers and that he had no contact with Chambers after January 1, 1937. The same day, the grand jury indicted Hiss on two counts of perjury, charging that he lied under oath in both these statements. Because the five-year statute of limitations had expired, the grand jury could not consider espionage charges. Well, it's because the Truman and Roosevelt administration stonewalled this case for longer than 5 years, right? Justice Chambers had gained the upper hand by voluntarily waiving immunity from slander when he went on the NBC television program and accused Hiss of being a communist. The influential columnist, Walter Lippmann, a socialist and Soviet intelligence source, whose secretary was Mary Price, a Soviet agent, suggested, I wonder how many U.S. Journalists were Soviet agents, right? Probably about half of them were. I would bet if they weren't Soviet agents for pay, that they were Jews and Soviet agents for voluntarily. suggested that Hiss turn the tables by waiving the statute of limitations on espionage. Hiss never took him up on that suggestion. The trials. On May 31, 1949, Alger Hiss went on trial for perjury in New York City. At trial, Hiss provided an all-star cast of character witnesses, including such notables as Adlai Stevenson, Justice Felix Frankfurter, and former Democratic presidential candidate John W. Davis. However, both Undersecretary Wells and Thayer testified that delivering the classified documents to a foreign power would enable them to break America's most secret code. Let me state that Stanley Hornbeck and Francis Thayer, we'll hear both those names here, they were both at one time superiors to Hiss in the justice, in the State Department. At Hiss's first perjury trial, Hornbeck testified that an unnamed friend had warned him that Hiss was a communist and fellow traveler, but he disregarded the warning. At the second trial, Hornbeck testified that on at least two occasions he was warned that Hiss was a communist. This is that Alger Hiss that kept getting promoted, right? And Hornbeck knew he was a communist or rejected warnings that he was a communist and kept promoting him, right? Hornbeck named Bullitt as his source and John Foster Dulles, who had recommended Hiss for the Carnegie Endowment, likewise testified at that trial that various people had warned him that Hiss was a communist. It seems to me all the Hiss trial, everybody who comes to Hiss's defense, that they should all be seen as exposing themselves as communists. The prosecution called Hedda Massing, but at the first trial, Judge Samuel H. Kaufman, who, what religion do you think he is, ruled that her testimony was irrelevant.
On the basis that it's too damning?
Yeah, right. At the second trial, Judge Henry W. Goddard allowed her to testify about Hiss's 1935 attempt to get Noel Field to transfer from her, meaning Hedda Massing's, OGPU group, she was another aspiring leader, right, to Hiss's GRU group. To avoid testifying, Field fled to the East Bloc. Let me say that Noel Field was an exposed communist spy, and he worked at the State Department in the 1930s. We have name after name after name in the government and the Roosevelt administration that are communists. Hiss's attorney conceded that the stolen documents had been copied on Hiss's Woodstock typewriter, telling the jury the question was not what typewriter was used, but who the typist was. The defense reverted to Hiss's original insanitary defense. Let me say that Hiss's attorney had to make that concession because three of his own experts told him it was true, right? That they couldn't hire an expert that would lie for them, I guess. I don't know. The defense reverted to Hiss's original insanity defense, to wit, that Chambers was insane, not Hiss. Calling a psychiatrist, Dr. Carl Binger, who attempted to psychoanalyze Chambers without interviewing him, testifying that Mr. Chambers is suffering from a condition known as a psychopathic personality. So thoroughly did his testimony collapse under scrutiny that the prosecutor's cross-examination of Binger has been used as a model to teach generations of law students. Among the symptoms of psychopathic personality, Binger mentioned abnormal sexuality. An important part of the Hiss defense strategy was to exploit Chambers' sexual preference in order to portray him as mentally ill and therefore not a credible witness. Hiss himself dictated for the record a rumor that Chambers had been treated in 1938 for gonorrhea, frigidity, shock, and persecution complex, which was all lies. Writing in Oxford University's Oxonian Review, professed liberal Daniel Hemmel sums up, quote, "What is striking about the Hiss trial is not that the prosecution engaged in shameless red-baiting, it did not, but that Hiss's defense team engaged in shameless gay-baiting. Unable to discredit Chambers based on the facts of the case, Hiss's lawyers with the defendant's encouragement, sought to smear Chambers based on the fact that he was a bisexual. Fortunately, the jurors in his case were not as horrifyingly homophobic as his and his attorneys. In retrospect, if either side of the trial engaged in egregious behavior, it was the defense, not the prosecution. In other words, the communists, most sexual deviants, I should say, happened to sympathize with communists, right, and liberals. And Chambers was obviously one of them, but Hiss was quick to throw one of his own under the bus, and we've seen that before, right?
Absolutely.
Hiss's friend and former colleague, Charles Wyszanski, senior district judge of the U.S. District Court in Boston, testified in both trials in defense of Hiss. Wyszanski, what religion you think he is, who initially had supposed Hiss innocent, later concluded that Hiss was guilty, as did Hiss's own attorney, William L. Aubrey.
Wyszanski is probably the same religion of Dzerzhinsky.
Yeah, right. On June 8, 1949, the jurors voted 8-4 for conviction, resulting in a hung jury in Hiss's first trial. The second trial began on November 17, 1949, and on January 21, 1950, the jury took less than 24 hours to return a unanimous verdict, guilty on both counts. In his pre-sentencing statement, Hiss said, "I am confident," this is funny, right? "I am confident that in the future, the full facts showing Whitaker Chambers was able to carry out forgery by typewriter will be developed." In other words, they'll be made up, right? Concerning the four handwritten documents Hiss had admitted were in his own handwriting, he was silent. A KGB memo notes that GRU agent Leonard, identified as chief of one of the main divisions in the State Department and a member of Carl's group, meaning Chambers, was convicted at the beginning of 1950. In other words, this KGB memo proves, again, it's another Russian document that proves that Hiss was a Soviet spy, right? The only senior American diplomat convicted...
Did they hold him at gunpoint and make him write those four documents? Did they drug him? How did they hypnotize
him? Well, right. He's absolutely guilty. The evidence is beyond damning, right? The only senior American diplomat convicted of an espionage-related crime in 1950 was Alger Hiss, whom Gorski in his memo identified as Leonard in 1948. So here he's identified as Leonard again. And it's without a doubt that Alger Hiss was a Soviet agent, but the left still tries to cover for him today. And that the argument over Hiss's guilt prevents people from looking past Hiss's guilt to all of the treachery that was performed by Hiss during his tenure in the State Department and to all of the other communists in the Roosevelt administration that worked with him. The argument over his guilt has been the centerpiece of the entire view of this entire history of the end of World War II and the American capitulation to the Soviets at every turn.
Where his guilt should be a foregone conclusion.
His guilt should be a foregone conclusion, and we should be looking at how the hell we elected a bunch of communists to hand over the world to the Soviets, and we fought for it. And nobody will ever look at that because we're still arguing about Hiss's guilt. And people buy this bullshit from a communist media. They're all communists. If you're a Jew, you're a communist in the first place. And Christians just don't understand that. Hiss's guilt should have been a foregone conclusion and when the FBI first reported him to Roosevelt. And Roosevelt just blew it off. And it's obscured, it's obfuscated the entire political debate ever since. Because it's prevented us from looking at the Roosevelt administration as a whole. It's prevented us from looking at the forces that were behind Yalta, that were behind the takeover, the communist takeover of China, the giveaway of China to communists. That's how it really should be characterized. And this goes into a whole lot of other things, too, like the death of Patton, and there's a whole lot of other events that are involved and happened under the purview of these same people. They were all communists. The whole State Department under Franklin Roosevelt, they were communists, and they were working for the interests of Soviet Russia. Dean Acheson, Alger Hiss, and half of the rest of them that were Roosevelt's closest and advisors. They were all communists, and they were fully all the way through the war and well into the Truman administration, and some of them even beyond that, working for the interests of Bolshevik Russia, of Stalin's Russia, and international Jewry, of course. Because
they're still doing it today, the ones that are...
Well, right, absolutely.
Their descendants.
Right, and most of the clowns, even in the right wing, are still arguing that Hiss was guilty. And it should be a foregone conclusion, like you said. You can't convince a wolf that the wolf is a wolf. They don't recognize the nature of the enemy. And only two-seedline Christian identity recognizes the nature of the enemy. Because they don't recognize the nature of the enemy, they keep trying to convince the enemy that they're wrong.
So basically, we want to shoot the fox before it gets in the hen house, and they want to argue about whether or not it's really a fox.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, it's getting in the hen house and killing all the hens.
On June 8, 1949, the jurors voted. I'm sorry, I read this. I'm not going to read it again. Hiss was sentenced to 2 concurrent 5-year terms in federal prison. The judge gave him a big break for doing that because he could have sentenced him. He should have sentenced him to 2 consecutive 5-year terms, which he had every right to do, right? Secretary of State Dean Acheson provoked outrage by commenting, "Whatever the outcome of any appeal which Mr. Hiss or his lawyer may take, I do not intend to turn my back on Alger Hiss." Well, which is incredible, right? I mean, Dean Acheson exposes himself as a co-conspirator, as far as I'm concerned, just by that statement. Eleanor Roosevelt, the ugliest woman to ever step foot in Washington, D.C., added to the furor with her her comment, quote, "It seems rather horrible to condemn someone on the word of someone else who admits to guilt." Well, if we follow that case, Hiss condemned himself, right? He pushed the whole thing with Whitaker Chambers. He pushed it all. He challenged Chambers to say it in public. He's the one that filed suit against Chambers, and it all backfired, blew up in his face. It was his own arrogance that got him in trouble, that got him caught, because Truman was doing everything he could to prevent him from getting caught. Time magazine commented that she so obviously had not been paying much attention, being unaware of or determined to ignore, I would say determined to ignore, the corroborating evidence introduced by the government. Now, remember that the Hisses were close friends with the Roosevelts, right, when Hiss was at the State Department throughout the 40s. By that June, the U.S. Army was persuaded that Ailes, meaning the Soviet spy codenamed Ailes, was Hiss. General of the Army Omar Bradley, yeah, he's a good one, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, informed President Truman that Venona had positively identified Hiss and Harry Dexter White as Soviet agents. According to Bradley, Truman said, "That GD stuff, every time it bumps into us, it gets bigger and bigger. It's likely to take us down." Harry Truman was all about politics, and he didn't care about truth and justice. They called him give him hell, Harry, and that's exactly what he gave us, was hell. Hiss appealed, but in December 1950, his conviction was affirmed by the U.S. Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court twice denied him certiorari, meaning they wouldn't hear his case, and later denied his petition for a writ of error, coram nobis, orchestrated by longtime Communist Party member Viktor Rabinowitz. Well, why would Viktor Rabinowitz, a known longtime communist, if Hiss wasn't a communist, why would he be even accepting this man's help?
One American helping another.
Well, right. Communist Jews for the defense of Hiss. has served 44 months of his five-year sentence in Lewisburg Federal Prison. That's in Pennsylvania. It's a tough place. There, at his best, his best friends were the gangsters, whom he later compared to prisoners of war in terms of solidarity, hierarchy, and discipline. Hiss even provided legal advice to his fellow inmate, the notorious mafia boss Frank Costello. Hiss called the gangsters the most stable group in any prison and the healthiest inmates of the prison because they had absolutely no sense of guilt. Well, of course they don't. They think they are prisoners of war. They think that everything that they do is legitimate and fair, and the government's tyrannical because it won't let them extort and do everything that they do. I mean, the gangster mentality is totally contrary to all good civilization, there's no doubt. Hiss admitted that he, too, never felt guilt about anything he had ever done. As one Hiss biographer comments, an incredible statement from anyone. Later in life, Hiss was released in 1954. Disbarred, he became a salesman. 5 years later, Alger Hiss and Priscilla Hiss separated. In the late 1960s, Hiss met Mrs. Isabel Dowden Johnson, a former editor at the New York Times and ex-wife of the communist screenwriter Lester Cole, a member of the Hollywood Ten. So she's a communist too, right? Priscilla reportedly had a breakdown in which she said she was tired of all the lies and cover-ups. She admitted that her husband was guilty right there and complained that Alger Hiss was willing to sacrifice us all on the altar of his vindication. Following Priscilla's death in 1984, Alger and Isabel married. As a result of his role in the Hiss case, Nixon had been elected to the Senate in 1950. 2 years later, GOP presidential candidate Dwight Eisenhower made him his running mate. Probably because he knew it would give him a boost, right? Unable to forgive Nixon for his part in nailing Hiss, the establishment launched an unprecedented liberal media attack against him. Well, of course, the communists wouldn't want Nixon to win, right? That year, Whitaker Chambers wrote to Nixon, "The attack on you shows how deeply the enemy fears you as he always fears and seeks to destroy. A combination of honesty and fighting courage. Be proud to be attacked, for the attackers are the enemies of all of us." Too few recent public figures does this nation owe as much as to you. That's clumsily worded. God help us if we ever forget it. Well, Chambers died in 1961 at the age of 60, so he didn't get to see Watergate, right? And the Jews' revenge on Nixon. Nixon was elected president in 1968, reelected in a landslide in 1972, but the left loathed Nixon for his role in the Hiss case and in Vietnam. By 1974, the Watergate scandal forced Nixon to resign, giving some credence to a wide spectrum of conspiracy theories involving fake typewriters, phony microfilm, and various collusions among the FBI, Nixon, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and the CIA, the radical right, and the KGB. In other words, because Nixon was discredited by Watergate, that he faked the whole Hiss thing, right? It was all Nixon dummied up the whole thing. It is basically what the position of the left was. In 1975, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court granted Hiss's petition for readmittance to the State Bar of Massachusetts, although the court's ruling stated, "Nothing we have said here should be construed as detracting one iota from the fact that in considering Hiss's petition, we considered him to be guilty as charged." So they readmitted him to the bar. With the rise in Massachusetts, anything could happen if you're a communist, right? With the rise of radical left-wing politics and the so-called New Left in the 60s, Hiss became a sought-out speaker on college campuses. Barred College, so we could corrupt another generation of American youth, right? Barred College established an Alger Hiss Distinguished Professorship in Social Studies, formerly held by eco-socialist, the Green Movement is not that new, Joel Koval, a Jew, who declared that America's obsession with anti-communism during the Cold War led the U.S. to become the enemy of humanity. Well, in reality, as we learn from the New Testament, the Jews are the enemies of humanity, aren't they? By the time Nixon died in 1994, Foreign Policy magazine could assign the task of reviewing his posthumous book, Beyond Peace, to his embittered foe, George McGovern, who took the opportunity to avenge his humiliating 49-state landslide defeat by Nixon, writing without explanation, quote, "The evidence that Hiss was a security risk to the United States simply is not convincing." Does that take balls or what for George McGovern to write something like that? That takes a lot. That's incredible.
By what standard? Talmudic standards?
Right. Labeling Hiss's conviction dubious and suggesting that Nixon's prosecution of Alger Hiss probably belongs on the same level as political demagoguery of the worst sort, unscrupulous attacks on the patriotism of deeply devoted public servants of the first rank. George McGovern was a communist. There's no doubt. George McGovern was a total communist. The tide turned against Hiss in 1978 with the publication of, guess what, Alan Weinstein's book, Perjury. So we see the Jew is going to tell on the communists, right? Which shifted the scholarly consensus to acceptance of Hiss's guilt. My summary of this is that the Jews had won the culture battle in the 50s and 60s, so now they could throw Hiss under the bus in order to maintain an appearance of respectability. That's how I view this, right? I mean, I could be wrong, but that's my summary of it. This consensus was strengthened by the October 1996 release by the CIA and NSA of the Venona decrypts, including the Ailes transmission of March 30, 1945. The following month, on December 15, 1996, Alger Hiss died. According to Professor Emeritus John B. Fleming of Princeton, Hiss continued to lie until his dying day. By then, just about everyone conceded that he was guilty. Reported the liberal left Salon.com that the brilliant, suave, well-educated, well-connected lawyer diplomat had indeed been a communist and a spy for the Soviet Union during the 30s and 40s. Further confirmation came in 2009 when the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars posted Vasiliev's notebooks online. Given the fervor exhibited by his loyalists, observes Library of Congress Cold War historian John Earl Haynes and Emory University professor Harvey Clare, it is unlikely that anything will convince the remaining diehards. Asked what evidence he would accept of Hiss's guilt, reported ex-communist Sidney Hook. Where do you think he was a professor? Columbia University. Even if Hiss himself were to confess his guilt, he said, "I would not believe it." Incredible. That's the end of the Alger Hiss presentation here. And I'm sorry it was long, but I really think that the whole thing has to be better understood than even what we presented, but because it's defined a lot of the political debate throughout the last, from the 50s through the 90s, and it shows how loath we've been to just get to the point and to set aside this debate and understand it. Yeah, you know, in light of the evidence, basically Hiss was his own worst enemy in exposing himself. But this should be no doubt. The evidence is astounding that he was a communist right from the 1940s, and the Democratic Party, what was in the full employ of it seems to me, of the Bolsheviks and the capitalist communists in this nation. And they ran cover all through for 50 years. They're still running cover. They're still communists. And now the Republican Party is no better. The neocons are basically all communists.
And Putin could come out tomorrow and declassify Soviet documents and say Hiss was a communist spy, and they'd still be running cover saying, "Oh, it's just Russian propaganda."
Well, absolutely. And it's incredible the way conservatives in this nation have failed to see the truth and failed to properly assess the political debate. But I mean, that's the word of God at work. But we should still recognize it.
All right, then. So we will pick up next week, then.
Yes, praise Yahweh. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Praise Yahweh.